The second ancillary fact, which proceeded from the first, was that all of this could be traced directly back to Heidi. It had been her fault, all of it. He had not asked her to do what she had done. He had not said, "Say, how about you jack me off while we drive home, Heidi? It's 3 miles, you got time." No, she had just done it, and, should you wonder, her timing had been ghastly. Yes, it had been her fault, but the old gypsy hadn't known that, and so Halleck had received the curse, and Halleck had now lost a grand total of 61 pounds, and there she sat, and there were brown circles under her eyes, and her skin looked too sallow. But those brown circles weren't going to kill her, were they? No, ditto the sallow skin. The old gypsy hadn't touched her. So the moment when he might have confessed his fears to her, when he might have said simply, "I believe I'm losing weight because I have been cursed," that moment passed. The moment of crude and unalloyed hate, an emotional boulder shot out of his subconscious by some crude and primitive catapult, passed with it. "Listen to me," he said, and like a good wife, she had responded, "What, Billy?" "I'll go back and see Mike Houston again," he said, which was not what he had originally intended to say at all. "Tell him to go ahead and book the metabolic series. As Albert Einstein was wont to say..." "What the fuck?" "Oh, Billy," she said, and held her arms out to him. He went into them, and because there was comfort there, he felt shame for his bright hate of only moments ago. But in the days which followed, as Fairview Spring proceeded at its usual understated and slightly preppy pace into Fairview Summer, the hate recurred more and more often, in spite of all he could do to stop it or hold it back. Lita Rossington opened the door and looked at Halleck as if she had never seen him before. The overhead light in the hall behind her caught her gaunt but aristocratic cheekbones, the black hair which was severely pulled back and showing just the first traces of white. No, Halleck thought, not white, silver. Lita's never going to have anything as plebeian as white hair. The lawn green Dior dress, a simple little thing that had probably cost no more than $1,500. Her gaze made him acutely uncomfortable. "Have I lost so much weight? She doesn't even know who I am," he thought. But even with his new paranoia about his personal appearance, he found that hard to believe. His face was gaunter, there were a few new worry lines around his mouth, and there were discolored pouches under his eyes from lack of sleep, but otherwise his face was the same old Billy Halleck face. The ornamental lamp at the other end of the Rossington dooryard, a wrought-iron facsimile of an 1880s New York street lamp, Horchow Collection, $687 plus mailing, cast only a dim wash of light up this far, and he was wearing his jacket. Surely she couldn't see how much weight he'd lost. Or could she? "Lita, it's Bill. Bill Halleck." "Of course it is. Hello, Billy." Still her hand hovered below her chin, half-fisted, touching the skin of her upper throat in a quizzical, pondering gesture. Although her features were incredibly smooth for her 59 years, the facelifts hadn't been able to do much for her neck. The flesh there was loose, not quite wattled. "She's drunk, maybe, or..." He thought of Houston, tidily tucking little Bolivian snowdrifts up his nose. "Drugs? Lita Rossington? Hard to believe of anyone who can bid a 2-0 trump with a strictly ho-hum hand and then make it good. And on the heels of that, she's scared. Desperate. What's this? And does it tie in somehow with what's happening to me?" That was crazy, of course. And yet he felt an almost frenzied need to know why Lita Rossington's lips were pressed so tight, why, even in the dim light, and despite the best cosmetics money could buy, The flesh under her eyes looked almost as baggy and discolored as the flesh under his own. Why, the hand that was now fiddling at the neckline of her Dior dress was quivering slightly. Billy and Leda Rossington considered each other in utter silence for perhaps 15 seconds, and then spoke at exactly the same time. "Leda is Carrie. Carrie's not here, Billy. He's..." She stopped. He made a gesture for her to go on. "He's been called back to Minnesota. His sister is very ill." "That's interesting," Halleck said, "since Carrie doesn't have any sisters." She smiled. It was an attempt at the well-bred, pained sort of smile polite people save for those who have been unintentionally rude. It didn't work. It was merely a pulling of the lips, more grimace than smile. "Sister, did I say? All of this has been very trying for me, for us. His brother, I mean. His..." "Leda." "Carrie's an only child," Halleck said gently. "We went over our sibs one drunk afternoon in the Hoster lounge. Must have been, 4 years ago. The Hoster burned down not long after. That head shop, the King in Yellow, is there now. My daughter buys her jeans there." He didn't know why he was going on. In some vague way he supposed it might set her at ease if he did. But now, in the light from the hall and the dimmer light from the wrought-iron yard lamp, he saw the bright track of a single tear running from her right eye almost to the corner of her mouth, and the arc below her left eye glimmered. As he watched, his words tangling in each other and coming to a confused stop, she blinked twice, rapidly, and the tear overflowed. A second bright track appeared on her left cheek. "Go away," she said. "Just go away, Billy, all right? Don't ask questions. I don't want to answer them." Halleck looked at her and saw a certain implacability in her eyes just below the swimming tears. She had no intention of telling him where Carrie was. And on an impulse he didn't understand either then or later, with absolutely no forethought or idea of gain, he pulled down the zipper of his jacket and held it open, as if flashing her. He heard her gasp of surprise. "Look at me, Leda," he said. "I've lost 70 pounds. Do you hear me? 70 pounds!
"That doesn't have anything to do with me," she cried in a low, harsh voice.
Her complexion had gone a sick clay color. Spots of rouge stood out on her face like the spots of color on a clown's cheeks. Her eyes looked raw. Her lips had drawn back from her perfectly capped teeth in a terrorized snarl. "No, but I need to talk to Carrie," Halleck persisted. He came up the first step of the porch, still holding his jacket open. "And I do," he thought. "I wasn't sure before, but I am now."
"Please tell me where he is, Leda. Is he here?"
Her reply was a question, and for a moment he couldn't breathe at all. He groped for the porch rail with one numb hand. Was it the gypsies, Billy? At last he was able to pull breath into his locked lungs. It came in a soft whoop. "Where is he, Leda?"
"Answer my question first. Was it the gypsies?"
Now that it was here, a chance to actually say it out loud, he found he had to struggle to do so. He swallowed hard, and nodded. "Yes, I think so. A curse, something like a curse." He paused.
"No, not something like. That's bullshit equivocation. I think I've had a gypsy curse laid on me."
He waited for her to shriek derisive laughter. He had heard that reaction so often in his dreams and in his conjectures. But her shoulders only slumped, and her head bowed. She was such a picture of dejection and sorrow that, in spite of his fresh terror, Halleck felt poignant, almost painful empathy for her, her confusion, and her terror. He climbed the second and third porch steps, touched her arm gently, and was shocked by the bright hate on her face when she raised her head. He stepped back suddenly, blinking, and then had to grab for the porch railing to keep from tumbling off the steps and landing on his prat. Her expression was a perfect reflection of the way he had momentarily felt about Heidi the other night. that such an expression should be directed against him, he found both inexplicable and frightening.
"It's your fault," she hissed at him. "All your fault. Why did you have to hit that stupid gypsy cunt with your car? It's all your fault."
He looked at her, incapable of speaking. "Cunt?" he thought confusedly. "Did I hear Leda Rossington say cunt? Who would have believed she even knew such a word?" His second thought was, "You've got it all wrong, Leda. It was Heidi, not me. And she's just great. In the pink, feeling her oats, hitting on all cylinders, kicking up Dickens, taking..." Then Leda's face changed. She looked at Halleck with a calmly polite expressionlessness. "Come in," she said. She brought him the martini he'd asked for in an oversized glass. Two olives and two tiny onions were impaled on the swizzle stick, which was a tiny gold-plated sword. Or maybe it was solid gold. The martini was very strong, which Halleck did not mind at all, although he knew from the drinking he'd done over the last 3 weeks that he'd be on his ass unless he went slow. His capacity for booze had shrunk along with his weight. Still, he took a big gulp to start with and closed his eyes with gratitude as the booze exploded warmth out from his stomach. Gin, wonderful high-calorie gin, he thought. "He is in Minnesota," she said dully, sitting down with her own martini. It was, if anything, bigger than the one she had given to Billy. "But not visiting relatives. He's at the Mayo Clinic."
"The Mayo? He's convinced it's cancer," she went on. "Mike Houston couldn't find anything wrong, and neither could the dermatologists he went to in the city, but he's still convinced it's cancer. Do you know that he thought it was herpes at first? He thought I'd caught herpes from someone."
Billy looked down, embarrassed, but he needn't have done so. Leda was looking over his right shoulder, as if reciting her tale to the wall. She took frequent bird-like sips at her drink. Its level sank slowly but steadily.
"I laughed at him when he finally brought it out. I laughed and said, 'Carrie, if you think that is herpes, then you know less about venereal diseases than I do about thermodynamics.' I shouldn't have laughed. But it was a way to relieve the pressure, you know. The pressure and the anxiety. Anxiety. The terror. Mike Houston gave him creams that didn't work, and the dermatologists gave him creams that didn't work, and then they gave him shots that didn't work. I was the one that remembered the old gypsy, the one with the half-eaten nose, and the way he came out of the crowd at the flea market in Raintree the weekend after your hearing, Billy. He came out of the crowd and touched him. He touched Carrie. He put his hand on Carrie's face and said something. I asked Carrie then, and I asked him later, after it had begun to spread, and he wouldn't tell me. He just shook his head."
Halleck took a second gulp of his drink, just as Leda set her glass, empty, on the table beside her.
"Skin cancer," she said. "He's convinced that's what it is, because skin cancer can be cured 90% of the time. I know the way his mind works. It would be funny if I didn't, wouldn't it, after living with him for 25 years, watching him sit on the bench and make real estate deals and drink and make real estate deals and chase other men's wives and make real estate deals and... Oh, shit, I sit here and wonder what I would say at his funeral if someone gave me a dose of pentothal an hour before the services. I guess it would come out something like... He bought a lot of Connecticut land, which is now shopping centers, and snapped a lot of bras, and drank a lot of wild turkey, and left me a rich widow, and I lived with him through the best years of my life, and I've had more fucking black glamour mink coats than I ever had orgasms, so let's all get out of here and go to a roadhouse somewhere and dance, and after a while, maybe somebody will get drunk enough to forget I've had my fucking chin tied up behind my fucking ears 3 fucking times, twice in fucking Mexico City and once in fucking Germany, and snap my fucking bra. Oh, fuck it. Why am I telling you all this? The only things men like you understand are humping, plea bargaining, and how to bet on pro football games."
She was crying again. Billy Halleck, who now understood the drink she had now almost finished, was far from her first of the evening. shifted uncomfortably in his chair and took a big gulp of his own drink. It banged into his stomach with untrustworthy warmth. He's convinced it's skin cancer, because he can't let himself believe in anything as ridiculously old-world, as superstitious, as penny dreadful novel as Gypsy Curses. But I saw something deep down in his eyes, Billy. I saw it a lot over the last month or so, especially at night, a little more clearly every night. I think that's one of the reasons he left, you know, because he saw me seeing it. Refill? Billy shook his head numbly and watched her go to the bar and mix herself a fresh martini. She made extremely simple martinis, he saw. You simply filled a glass with gin and tumbled in a couple of olives. They left twin trails of bubbles as they sank to the bottom. Even from where he was sitting, all the way across the room, he could smell the gin. What was it with Carrie Rossington? What had happened to him? Part of Billy Halleck most definitely did not want to know. Houston had apparently made no connection between what was happening to Billy and what was happening to Rossington. Why should he have? Houston didn't know about the gypsies. Also, Houston was bombing his brain with big white torpedoes on a regular basis. Lita came back and sat down again. "If he calls and says he's coming back," she told Billy calmly, "I'm going to our place on Captiva. It will be beastly hot this time of year, but if I have enough gin, I find I barely notice the temperature. I don't think I could stand to be alone with him any more. I still love him, yes, in my way I do, but I don't think I could stand it, thinking of him in the next bed, thinking he might touch me." She shivered. Some of her drink spilled. She drank the rest all at once, and then made a thick blowing sound, like a thirsty horse that had just drunk its fill. "Lita, what's wrong with him? What's happened?"
"Happened? Happened? Why, Billy, dear, I thought I'd told you, or that you knew somehow."
Billy shook his head. He was starting to believe he didn't know anything.
"He's growing scales. Carrie is growing scales."
Billy gaped at her. Lita offered a dry, amused, horrified smile and shook her head a little.
"No, that's not quite right. His skin is turning into scales. He has become a case of reverse evolution, a sideshow freak. He's turning into a fish or a reptile."
She laughed suddenly, a harsh, cawing shriek that made Halleck's blood run cold. She's tottering on the brink of madness, he thought. The revelation made him colder still. I think she'll probably go to Captiva no matter what happens. She'll have to get out of Fairview if she wants to save her sanity. Yes. Lita clapped both hands over her mouth and then excused herself, as if she had burped, or perhaps vomited, instead of laughed. Billy, incapable of speaking just then, only nodded and got up to make himself a fresh drink after all. She seemed to find it easier to talk now that he wasn't looking at her, now that he was at the bar with his back turned, and Billy purposely lingered there. Carrie had been furious, utterly furious, at being touched by the old gypsy. He had gone to see the Raintree chief of police, Alan Chalker, the following day. Chalker was a poker buddy, and he had been sympathetic. The gypsies had come to Raintree directly from Fairview, he told Carrie. Chalker said he kept expecting them to leave on their own. They had already been in Raintree for 5 days, and usually 3 days was about right. Just time enough for all the town's interested teenagers to have their fortunes told, and for a few desperately impotent men and a like number of desperately menopausal women to creep out to the encampment under cover of darkness and buy potions and nostrums and strange oily creams. After 3 days, the town's interest in the strangers always waned. Chalker had finally decided they were waiting for the flea market on Sunday. It was an annual event in Raintree, and drew crowds from all four of the surrounding towns. Rather than make an issue of their continuing presence, gypsies, he told Carrie, could be as ugly as ground wasps if you poke them too hard, he decided to let them work the departing flea market crowds, but if they weren't gone come Monday morning, he would move them along. But there had been no need. Come Monday morning, the farm field where the gypsies had camped was empty except for wheel ruts, empty beer and soda cans. The gypsies apparently had no interest in Connecticut's new bottle-and-can deposit law. The blackened remains of several small cook fires, and three or four blankets so lousy that the deputy chalker sent out to investigate would only poke at them with a stick, a long stick. Sometime between sundown and sunup, the gypsies had left the field, left Raintree, left Patchen County. Had, chalker told his old poker buddy Kerry Rossington, left the planet as far as he either knew or cared. And good riddance. On Sunday afternoon, the old gypsy man had touched Carrie's face. On Sunday night, they had left. On Monday morning, Carrie had gone to Chalker to lodge a complaint. Just what the legal basis of the complaint might have been, Leda Rossington didn't know. On Tuesday morning, the trouble had begun. After his shower, Carrie had come downstairs to the breakfast nook, wearing only his bathrobe, and had said, "Look at this." This turned out to be a patch of roughened skin, just a little above his solar plexus. The skin was a shade lighter than the surrounding flesh, which was an attractive coffee-with-cream shade. Golf, tennis, swimming, and a UV sun lamp in the winter kept his tan unvarying. The rough patch looked yellowish to her, the way the calluses on the heels of her feet sometimes got in very dry weather. She had touched it, her voice faltered momentarily here, and then drawn her finger away quickly. The texture was rough, almost pebbly, and surprisingly hard. Armored. That was the word that had risen unbidden in her mind. "You don't think that damn gypsy gave me something, do you?" Carrie asked worriedly. "Ringworm or impetigo or some damn thing like that?" "He touched your face, not your chest, dear," Leda had replied. "Now, get dressed quick as you can. We've got brioche. Wear the dark grease suit with the red tie and dress up Tuesday for me, will you? What a love you are." Two nights later, he had called her into the bathroom, his voice so like a scream that she had come on the run. All our worst revelations come in the bathroom, Billy thought. Carrie was standing with his shirt off, his razor humming, forgotten in one hand, his wide eyes staring into the mirror. The patch of hard yellowish skin had spread. It had become a blotch, a vaguely tree-like shape that spread upward to the area between his nipples and downward, widening, toward his belly button. This changed flesh was raised above the normal flesh of his belly and stomach by almost an eighth of an inch, and she saw there were deep cracks running through it. Several of them looked deep enough to slip the edge of a dime into. For the first time she thought he was beginning to look, well, scaly, and felt her gorge rise.
"What is it?"
he nearly screamed at her.
"Leda, what is it?"
"I don't know," she said, forcing her voice to remain calm. "But you've got to see Michael Houston. That much is clear. Tomorrow, Carrie."
"No, not tomorrow," he said, still staring at himself in the mirror, staring at the raised, arrowhead-shaped hump of harsh yellow flesh. "It may be better tomorrow. Day after tomorrow, if it isn't better, but not tomorrow."
"Carrie,
hand me that Nivea cream, Leda."
She did, and stood there a moment longer. But the sight of him smearing the white goo over that hard yellow flesh, listening to the pads of his fingers rasp over it, that was more than she could stand, and she fled back to her room. That was the first time, she told Halleck, that she had been consciously glad for the twin beds, consciously glad he wouldn't be able to turn over in his sleep and touch her. She had lain wakeful for hours, she said, hearing the soft rasp, rasp of his fingers moving back and forth across that alien flesh. He told her the following night that it was better. The night after that, he claimed it was better still. She supposed she should have seen the lie in his eyes, and that he was lying to himself more than he was to her. Even in his extremity, Carrie had remained the same selfish son of a bitch she supposed he had always been. But it hadn't all been Carrie's doing, she added sharply, still not turning back from the bar, where she was now fiddling aimlessly with the glasses. She had developed her own brand of highly specialized selfishness over the years. She had wanted, needed the illusion almost as much as he had. On the third night, he had walked into their bedroom wearing only his pajama pants. His eyes were soft and hurt, stunned. She had been rereading a Dorothy Sayers mystery. They were, for always and ever, her favorites. And it dropped from her fingers as she saw him. She would have screamed, she told Billy, but it seemed to her that all her breath was gone. And Billy had time to reflect that no human feeling was truly unique, although one might like to think so. Carrie Rossington had apparently gone through the same period of self-delusion followed by shattering self-awakening that Billy had gone through himself. Lita had seen that the hard yellow skin, the scales, there was no longer any way to think of them as anything else, now covered most of Carrie's chest and all of his belly. It was as ugly and thickly humped up as burn tissue. The cracks zigged and zagged every which way, deep and black, shading to a pinkish red deep down where you most definitely did not want to look. And although you might at first think those cracks were as random as the cracks in a bomb crater, after a moment or two, your helpless eye reported a different story. At each edge, the hard yellow flesh rose a bit more. Scales. Not fish scales, but great rough reptile scales, like those on a lizard or a gator or an iguana. The brown arc of his left nipple still showed. The rest of it was gone, buried under that yellow-black carapace. The right nipple was entirely gone, and a twisted ridge of this strange new flesh reached around and under his armpit toward his back like the grasping, surfacing claw of some unthinkable monstrosity. His navel was gone, and he lowered his pajama pants, she said. She was now working on her third drink, taking those same rapid, bird-like sips. First tears had begun to leak from her eyes, but that was all. That's when I found my voice again. I screamed at him to stop, and he did, but not before I'd seen it was sending fingers down into his groin. It hadn't touched his penis, at least it hadn't yet. But where it had advanced, his pubic hair was gone, and there were just those yellow scales. "I thought you said it was getting better," I said. "I honestly thought it was," he answered me, and the next day he made the appointment with Houston. Who probably told him, Halleck thought, about the college kid with no brain and the old lady with the third set of teeth, and asked if he'd like a short snort of the old brain squirts. A week later, Rossington had been seeing the best team of dermatologists in New York. They knew immediately what was wrong with him, they said, and a regimen of hard gamma X-rays had followed. The scaly flesh continued to creep and spread. It did not hurt, Rossington told her. There was a faint itching at the borders between his old skin and this horrible new invader, but that was all. The new flesh had absolutely no feeling at all. Smiling the ghastly, shocked smile that was coming to be his only expression, he told her that the other day he had lit a cigarette and crushed it out on his own stomach. Slowly. There had been no pain. None at all. She had put her hands up to her ears and screamed at him to stop. The dermatologists told Carrie they had been a bit off course. "What do you mean?" Carrie asked. "You guys said you knew. You said you were sure." "Well, they said these things happen. Rarely, ha-ha, very rarely. But now we have it licked. All the tests, they said, bore this new conclusion out. A regimen of hypovites, high-potency vitamins to those unfamiliar with high-priced doc talk, and glandular injections had followed. At the same time this new treatment was getting underway, the first scaly patches had begun to show up on Carrie's neck, the underside of his chin, and finally on his face. That was when the dermatologists finally admitted they were stumped. Only for the moment, of course. No such thing as incurable. Modern medicine, dietary regimen, and mumble-mumble, likewise blah-de-blah. Carrie would no longer listen to her if she tried to talk to him about the old gypsy, she told Halleck. Once he had actually raised his hand as if to strike her, and she had seen the first humping and roughening of the skin in the tender webbing between the thumb and forefinger on his right hand. "Skin cancer!" he shouted at her. "This is skin cancer, skin cancer, skin cancer! Now will you, for Christ's sweet sake, shut up about that old wog?" Of course, he was the one who was making at least nominal sense. She was the one who was talking in 14th-century absurdities. And yet she knew it had been the doing of the old gypsy who had stepped out of the crowd at the Rain Tree Flea Market and touched Carrie's face. She knew it, and in his eyes, even when he raised his hand to her that time, she saw that he knew it too. He had arranged for a leave of absence with Glenn Petrie, who was shocked to hear his old friend, fellow jurist and golf partner Carrie Rossington, had skin cancer. There had followed 2 weeks, Lita told Halleck, that she could barely bring herself to remember or speak of. Carrie had alternately slept like the dead, sometimes upstairs in their room, but just as often in the big overstuffed chair in his den or with his head in his arms at the kitchen table. He began to drink heavily every afternoon around 4. He would sit in the family room, holding the neck of a J.W. Dant whiskey bottle in one roughening, scaly hand, watching first syndicated comedy shows like Hogan's Heroes and the Beverly Hillbillies, then the local and national news, then syndicated game shows like The Joker's Wild and Family Feud, then 3 hours of prime time, followed by more news, followed by movies, until 2 or 3 in the morning. And all the while he drank whiskey like Pepsi Cola, straight from the bottle. On some of these nights, he would cry. She would come in and observe him weeping, while Warner Anderson, imprisoned inside their Sony large-screen TV, cried, "Let's go to the videotape," with the enthusiasm of a man inviting all his old girlfriends to go on a cruise to Aruba with him. On still other nights, mercifully few of them, he would rave like Ahab during the last days of the Pequod, shambling and stumbling through the house with a whiskey bottle held in a hand that was not really a hand anymore, shouting that it was skin cancer. Did she hear him? It was fucking skin cancer, and he had gotten it from the fucking UV lamp, and he was going to sue the dirty quacks that had done this to him, sue them right down to the motherfucking ground, litigate the bastards until they didn't have so much as a shit-stained pair of skivvies to stand up in. Sometimes, when he was in these moods, he broke things. "I finally realized that he was having these fits on the nights after Mrs. Marley came in to clean," she said dully. "He'd go up into the attic when she was here, you'd see. If she'd seen him, it would have been all over town in no time at all. It was the nights after she'd been in and he'd been up there in the dark that he felt most like an outcast, I think. Most like a freak."
"So he's gone to the Mayo Clinic?" Billy said.
"Yes," she said, and at last she looked at him. Her face was drunk and horrified.
"What's going to become of him, Billy? What can become of him?"
Billy shook his head. He hadn't the slightest idea. Furthermore, he found he had no more urge to contemplate the question than he'd had to contemplate that famous news photograph of the South Vietnamese general shooting the supposed Viet Cong collaborator in the head. In a weird way, he couldn't quite understand. This was like that.
"He chartered a private plane to fly to Minnesota. Did I tell you that? Because he can't bear to have people look at him. Did I tell you that, Billy?"
Billy shook his head again.
"What's going to become of him?"
"I don't know," Halleck said, thinking, "And just, by the way, what's going to become of me, Lita?"
"At the end, before he finally gave up and went, both of his hands were claws. His eyes were two bright little sparks of blue inside those pitted, scaly hollows. His nose..."
She stood up and wobbled toward him, hitting the corner of the coffee table hard enough with her leg to make it shift. She doesn't feel it now, Halleck thought, but she's going to have one hell of a painful bruise on her calf tomorrow, and if she's lucky, she'll wonder where she got it, or how. She grasped at his hand. Her eyes were great glittering pools of uncomprehending horror. She spoke with a gruesome, breathy confidentiality that prickled the skin of Billy's neck. Her breath was rank with undigested gin.
"He looks like an alligator now," she said in what was almost an intimate whisper. "Yes, that's what he looks like, Billy. Like something that just crawled out of a swamp and put on human clothes. It's like he's turning into an alligator. And I was glad he went. Glad. I think if he hadn't gone, I would have gone. Yes, just packed a bag and...
She was leaning closer and closer, and Billy stood up suddenly, unable to stand any more of this. Lita Rossington rocked back on her heels, and Halleck just barely managed to catch her by the shoulders. He had also drunk too much, it seemed. If he had missed her, she might very well have brained herself on the same glass-topped, brass-bound coffee table, trifles, $587 plus mailing, on which she had struck her leg. Only instead of waking up with a bruise, she could have waked up dead. Looking into her half-mad eyes, Billy wondered if she might not welcome death. "Lita, I have to go."
"Of course," she said. "Just came for the straight dope, didn't you, Billy dear?"
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm sorry about everything that's happened. Please believe me." And insanely, he heard himself adding, "When you talk to Carrie, give him my best."
"He's hard to talk to now," she said remotely. "It's happening inside his mouth. You see, it's thickening his gums, plating his tongue. I can talk to him, but everything he says to me, all his replies, come out in grunts."
He was backing into the hall, backing away from her, wanting to be free of her soft, relentlessly cultured tones, needing to be free of her gruesome, glittering eyes.
"He really is," she said. "Turning into an alligator, I mean. I expect that before long they may have to put him in a tank. They may have to keep his skin wet."
Tears leaked from her raw eyes, and Billy saw she was dribbling gin from her canted martini glass onto her shoes. "Good night, Lita," he whispered.
"Why, Billy? Why did you have to hit the old woman? Why did you have to bring this on Carrie and me? Why?"
"Lita,
come back in a couple of weeks," she said,
still advancing as Billy groped madly behind him for the knob of the front door, holding on to his polite smile by a huge act of will.
"Come back and let me have a look at you when you've lost another 40 or 50 pounds. I'll laugh and laugh and laugh."
He found the knob. He turned it. The cool air struck his flushed and overheated skin like a benison. "Good night, Lita. I'm sorry."
"Save your sorry,"
she screamed, and threw her martini glass at him. It struck the door jamb to Billy's right and shattered.
"Why did you have to hit her, you bastard? Why did you have to bring it on all of us? Why? Why? Why?"
Halleck made it to the corner of Park Lane and Lantern Drive, and then collapsed onto the bench inside the bus shelter, shivering as if with ague, his throat and stomach sour with acid indigestion, his head buzzing with gin. He thought, "I hit her and killed her, and now I'm losing weight and I can't stop. Carrie Rossington conducted the hearing. He let me off without so much as a tap on the wrist, and Carrie's in the Mayo Clinic. He's in the Mayo Clinic, and if you believe his wife, he looks like a fugitive from Maurice Sendak's alligators all around. Who else was involved in a way that the old gypsy might have decided called for revenge?" He thought of the two cops, rousting the gypsies when they came into town, when they had presumed to start doing their gypsy tricks on the town common. One of them had just been a spear carrier, of course. Just a patrol car jockey following orders. Whose orders? Why, the police chief's orders, of course. Duncan Hopley's orders. The gypsies had been rousted because they had no permit to perform on the common. But of course they would have understood that the message was somewhat broader than that. If you wanted gypsy folk out, there were plenty of ordinances. Vagrancy, public nuisance, spitting on the sidewalk, you name it. The gypsies had made a deal with a farmer out on the west side of town, a sour old man named Arncaster. There was always a farm, always a sour old farmer, and the gypsies always found him. Their noses have been trained to smell out guys like Arncaster, Billy thought now as he sat on the bench listening to the first droplets of spring rain strike the bus shelter's roof. Simple evolution. All it takes is 2,000 years of being moved along. You talk to a few people. Maybe Madame Azonka does a free reading or two. You sniff for the name of the fellow in town who owns land but owes money, the fellow who has no great love for the town or for town ordinances, the guy who posts his apple orchards during hunting season out of pure orneriness, because he'd rather let the deer have his apples than let the hunters have the deer. You sniff for the name and you always find it, because there's always at least one Arncaster in the richest towns, and sometimes there are two or three to choose among. They parked their cars and campers in a circle, just as their ancestors had drawn their wagons and handcarts into a circle 200, 400, 800 years before them. They obtained a fire permit, and at night there was talk and laughter and undoubtedly a bottle or two passed from hand to hand. All of this, Halleck thought, would have been acceptable to Hopley. It was the way things were done. Those who wanted to buy some of whatever the gypsies were selling could drive out the West Fairview Road to the Arncaster place. At least it was out of sight, and the Arncaster place was something of an eyesore to begin with. The farms the gypsies found always were. And soon they would move on to Raintree or Westport, and from thence out of view and thought. Except that after the accident, after the old gypsy man had made a nuisance of himself by turning up on the courthouse steps and touching Billy Halleck, the way things were done was no longer good enough. Hopley had given the gypsies 2 days, Halleck remembered, and when they showed no signs of moving along, he had moved them along. First, Jim Roberts had revoked their fire permit. Although there had been heavy showers every day for the previous week, Roberts told them that the fire danger had suddenly gone way, way up. Sorry. And, by the way, they wanted to remember that the same regulations which controlled campfires and cookfires also applied to propane stoves, charcoal fires, and brazier fires. Next, of course, Hopley would have gone around to visit a number of local businesses where Lars Arncaster had a credit line, a line of credit that was usually overextended. These would have included the hardware store, the feed and grain store on Raintree Road, the farmer's co-op in Fairview Village, and Normie's Sunoco. Hopley might also have gone to visit Zachary Marchant at the Connecticut Union Bank, the bank that held Arncaster's mortgage. All part of the job. Have a cup of coffee with this one, a spot of lunch with that one, perhaps something as simple as a couple of francs and lemonades purchased at Dave's Dog Wagon, a bottle of beer with the other one. And by sundown of the following day, everyone with a claim check on a little piece of Lars Arncaster's ass had given him a call, mentioning how really good it would be to have those damned gypsies out of town, how really grateful everyone would be. The result was just what Duncan Hopley had known it would be. Arncaster went to the gypsies, refunded the balance of whatever sum they had agreed upon for rent, and had undoubtedly turned a deaf ear to any protests they might have made. Halleck was thinking specifically of the young man with the bowling pins, who apparently had not as yet comprehended the immutability of his station in life. It wasn't as if the gypsies had a signed lease that would stand up in court. Sober, Arncaster might have told them they were just lucky he was an honest man and had refunded them the unused portion of what they had paid. Drunk, Arncaster was a 3 6-packs a night man, he might have been slightly more expansive. There were forces in town that wanted the gypsies gone, he might have told them. Pressure had been brought to bear, pressure that a poor dirt farmer like Lars Arncaster simply couldn't stand against. Particularly when half the so-called good people in town had the knife out for him to begin with. Not that any of the gypsies, with the possible exception of Juggler, Billy thought, would need a chapter-and-verse rendition. Billy got up and walked slowly back home through a cold, drifting rain. There was a light burning in the bedroom, Heidi waiting up for him. Not the patrol car jockey. No need for revenge there. Not Arncaster. He had seen a chance for $500 cash money, and he'd sent them on their way because he'd had to do so. Duncan Hopley? Hopley, maybe. A strong maybe, Billy amended. In one way, Hopley was just another species of trained dog whose most urgent directives were aimed at preserving Fairview's well-oiled status quo. But Billy doubted if the old gypsy man would be disposed to take such a bloodlessly sociological view of things, and not just because Hopley had rousted them so efficiently following the hearing. Rousting was one thing. They were used to that. Hopley's failure to investigate the accident which had taken the old woman's life. Ah, that was something else, wasn't it? Failure to investigate? Hell, Billy, don't make me laugh. Failure to investigate is a sin of omission. What Hopley did was to throw as much dirt as he could over any possible culpability, beginning with the conspicuous lack of a breathalyzer test. It was a cover-up on general principles. You know it. And Carrie Rossington knew it, too. The wind was picking up and the rain was harder now. He could see it cratering the puddles in the street. The water had a queer, polished look under the amber high-security street lamps that lined Lantern Drive. Overhead, branches moaned and creaked in the wind, and Billy Halleck looked up uneasily. I ought to go see Duncan Hopley. Something glimmered, something that might have been the spark of an idea. Then he thought of Lita Rossington's drugged, horrified face. He thought of Lita saying, "He's hard to talk to now. It's happening inside his mouth, you see. Everything he says to me comes out in grunts." Not tonight. He'd had enough for tonight. "Where did you go, Billy?" She was in bed, lying in a pool of light thrown by the reading lamp. Now she laid her book aside on the coverlet, looked at him, and Billy saw the dark brown hollows under her eyes. Those brown hollows did not exactly overwhelm him with pity, at least not tonight. For just a moment he thought of saying, "I went to see Carrie Rossington, but since he was gone I ended up having a few drinks with his wife, the kind of drinks the Green Giant must have when he's on a toot. And you'll never guess what she told me, Heidi dear. Carrie Rossington, who grabbed your tit once at the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve, is turning into an alligator. When he finally dies, they can turn him into a brand new product. Here come the Judge Pocketbooks." "Nowhere," he said. "Just out, walking, thinking." "You smell like you fell into the juniper bushes on your way home." "I guess I did, in a manner of speaking, only it was Andy's pub I actually fell into." "How many did you have?" "A couple." "It smells more like 5. Heidi, are you cross-examining me?" "No, honey, but I wish you wouldn't worry so much. Those doctors will probably find out what's wrong when they do the metabolic series." Halleck grunted. She turned her earnest, scared face toward him. "I just thank God it isn't cancer." He thought, and almost said, that it must be nice for her to be on the outside. It must be nice to be able to see gradations of the horror. He didn't say it, but some of what he felt must have shown on his face, because her expression of tired misery intensified. "I'm sorry," she said. It seems hard to say anything that isn't the wrong thing." "You know it, babe," he thought, and the hate flashed up again, hot and sour. On top of the gin, it made him feel both depressed and physically ill. It receded, leaving shame in its wake. Carrie's skin was changing into God knew what, something fit only to be seen in a circus sideshow tent. Duncan Hopley might be just fine, or something even worse might be waiting for Billy there. Hell, losing weight wasn't so bad, was it? He undressed, careful to turn off her reading lamp first, and took Heidi in his arms. She was stiff against him at first. Then, just when he began to think it was going to be no good, She softened. He heard the sob she tried to swallow back and thought unhappily that if all the storybooks were right, that there was nobility to be found in adversity and character to be built in tribulation, then he was doing a piss-poor job of both finding and building.
"Heidi, I'm sorry," he said.
"If I could only do something," she sobbed.
"If I could only do something, Billy, you know..."
"You can," he said, and touched her breast. They made love. He began thinking, "This one is for her," and discovered it had been for himself after all. Instead of seeing Leda Rossington's haunted face and shocked glittering eyes in the darkness, he was able to sleep. The next morning, the scale registered 176. He had arranged a leave of absence from the office in order to accommodate the metabolic series. Kirk Pinchley had been almost indecently willing to accommodate his request, leaving Halleck with a truth he would just as soon not have faced. They wanted to get rid of him. With two of his former three chins now gone, his cheekbones evident for the first time in years, the other bones of his face showing almost as clearly, he had turned into the office boogeyman.
"Hell yes," Pinchley had responded almost before Billy's request was completely out of his mouth. Pinchley spoke in a too-hearty voice, the voice people adopt when everyone knows something is seriously wrong and no one wants to admit it. He dropped his eyes, staring at the place where Halleck's belly used to be.
"Take however much time you need, Bill."
3 days should do it, he'd replied. Now he called Pinchley back from the payphone at Barker's coffee shop and told him he might have to take more than 3 days. More than 3 days, yes, but maybe not just for the metabolic series. The idea had returned, glimmering. It was not a hope yet, nothing as grand as that. But it was something.
"How much time?" Pinchley asked him.
"I don't know for sure," Halleck said. 2 weeks, maybe, possibly a month." There was a momentary silence at the other end, and Halleck realized Pinchley was reading a subtext. "What I really mean, Kirk, is that I'll never be back. They finally diagnosed the cancer. Now comes the cobalt, the drugs for pain, the interferon if we can get it, the latril if we wig out and decide to head for Mexico. The next time you see me, Kirk, I'll be in a long box with a silk pillow under my head." And Billy, who had been afraid and not much more for the last 6 weeks, felt the first thin stirrings of anger. "That's not what I'm saying, goddammit. At least not yet."
"No problem, Bill. We'll want to turn the hood matter over to Ron Baker, but I think everything else can hang fire for a while longer."
"The fuck you do. You'll start turning over everything else to staff this afternoon, and as for the hood litigation, you turned it over to Ron Baker last week. He called Thursday afternoon and asked me where Sally put the fucking con gas depositions. Your idea of hanging fire, Kirk, baby, has to do solely with Sunday afternoon chicken barbecues at your place in Vermont, so don't bullshit a bullshitter."
"I'll see he gets the file," Billy said, and could not resist adding, "I think he's already got the con gas deps."
A thoughtful silence at Kirk Pinchley's end as he digested this. Then,
"Well, if there's anything I can do..."
"There is something," Billy said, "although it sounds a little Looney Tunes."
"What's that?"
His voice was cautious now. "You remember my trouble this early spring, the accident?"
"Yes."
"The woman I struck was a gypsy. Did you know that?"
"It was in the paper," Pinchley said reluctantly. "She was a part of, a band, I guess you'd say, a band of gypsies. They were camping out here in Fairview. They made a deal with a local farmer who needed cash."
Hang on a second," Kirk Pinchley said, his voice a trifle waspy, totally unlike his former paid mourner's tone. Billy grinned a little.
He knew this second tone and liked it infinitely better. He could visualize Pinchley, who was 45, bald, and barely 5 feet tall, grabbing a yellow pad in one of his beloved flare fineliners. When he was in high gear, Kirk was one of the brightest, most tenacious men Halleck knew.
"Okay, go on. Who was this local farmer?"
"Arncaster, Lars Arncaster. After I hit the woman..."
"Her name?"
Halleck closed his eyes and dragged for it. It was funny, all of this, and he hadn't even thought of her name since the hearing. "Lemke," he said finally. "Her name was Susanna Lemke."
"L-E-M-P-K-E?"
"No P."
"Okay."
"After the accident, the gypsies found that they'd worn out their welcome in Fairview. I've got reason to believe they went on to Raintree. I want to know if you can trace them from there. I want to know where they are now. I'll pay the investigative fees out of my own pocket."
"Damned right you will," Pinchley said jovially. "Well, if they went north into New England, we can probably track them down. But if they headed south into the city or over into Jersey, I don't know. Billy, are you worried about a civil suit?"
"No," he said. "But I have to talk to that woman's husband, if that's what he was."
"Oh,"
Pinchley said. And once again Halleck could read the man's thoughts as clearly as if he'd spoken them aloud. "Billy Halleck is neatening up his affairs, balancing the books. Maybe he wants to give the old gyp a check. Maybe he only wants to face him and apologize and give the man a chance to pop him one in the eye."
"Thank you, Kirk," Halleck said. "Don't mention it," Pinchley said. "You just work on getting better."
"Okay," Billy said and hung up. His coffee had gotten cold. He was really not very surprised to find that Rand Foxworth, the assistant chief, was running things down at the Fairview police station. He greeted Halleck cordially enough, but he had a harried look, and to Halleck's practiced eye, there seemed to be far too many papers in the in basket on Foxworth's desk and nowhere near enough in the out basket. Foxworth's uniform was impeccable, but his eyes were bloodshot.
"Dunk's had a touch of the flu," he said in answer to Billy's question. The response had the canned feel of one that had been given many times. "He hasn't been in for the last couple of days."
"Oh," Billy said. "The flu."
"That's right," Foxworth said, and his eyes dared Billy to make something of it.
The receptionist told Billy that Dr. Houston was with a patient. "It's urgent. Please tell him I only need a word or two with him." It would have been easier in person, but Halleck hadn't wanted to drive all the way across town. As a result, he was sitting in a telephone booth, an act he wouldn't have been able to manage not long ago, across the street from the police station. At last, Houston came on the line. His voice was cool, distant, more than a bit irritated. Halleck, who was either getting very good at reading subtext or becoming very paranoid indeed, heard a clear message in that cool tone. "You're not my patient anymore, Billy. I smell some irreversible degeneration in you that makes me very, very nervous. Give me something I can diagnose and prescribe for. That's all I ask. If you can't give me that, there's really no basis for commerce between us. We played some pretty good golf together, but I don't think either of us would say we were ever friends. I've got a Sony beeper, $200,000 worth of diagnostic equipment, and a selection of drugs to call on so wide that, well, if my computer printed them all out, the sheet would stretch from the front doors of the country club all the way down to the intersection of Park Lane and Lantern Drive. With all that going for me, I feel smart. I feel useful. Then you come along and make me look like a 17th-century doctor with a bottle of leeches for high blood pressure and a trepanning chisel for headaches. And I don't like to feel that way, Big Bill. Not at all. Nothing toot sweet about that. So get lost. I wash my hands of you. I'll come and see you in your coffin. Unless, of course, my beeper beeps and I have to leave." "Modern medicine," Billy muttered.
"What, Bill? You'll have to speak up. I don't want to give you short shrift, but my PA called in sick and I'm going out of my skull this morning."
"Just a single question, Mike," Billy said. "What's wrong with Duncan Hopley?" Utter silence from the other end for almost 10 seconds, then,
What makes you think anything is?
He's not at the station. Rand Foxworth says he has the flu, but Rand Foxworth lies like old people fuck.
There was another long pause.
As a lawyer, Billy, I shouldn't have to tell you that you're asking for privileged information. I could get my ass in a sling.
If somebody tumbles to what's in that little bottle you keep in your desk, your ass could be in a sling, too. A sling so high it would give a trapeze artist acrophobia.
More silence. When Houston spoke again, his voice was stiff with anger, and there was an undercurrent of fear.
Is that a threat?
No, Billy said wearily. Just don't go all prissy on me, Mike. Tell me what's wrong with Hopley, and that'll be the end of it.
Why do you want to know?
Oh, for Christ's sake. You're living proof that a man can be just as dense as he wants to be. Do you know that, Mike?
I don't have the slightest idea what...
You've seen three very strange illnesses in Fairview over the last month. You didn't make any connection among them. In a way, that's understandable enough. They were all different in their specifics. On the other hand, they were all similar in the very fact of their strangeness. I have to wonder if another doctor, one who hadn't discovered the pleasure of plugging $50 worth of cocaine up his pump every day, for instance, might not have made the connection in spite of the diverse symptoms.
Now wait just a goddamn minute.
No, I won't. You asked why I wanted to know, and by God, I'm going to tell you. I'm losing weight, steadily. I go on losing weight even if I stuff 8,000 calories a day down my throat. Carrie Rossington has gotten some bizarre skin disease. His wife says he's turning into a sideshow freak. He's gone to the Mayo Clinic. Now I want to know what's wrong with Duncan Hopley, and secondarily, I want to know if you've had any other inexplicable cases.
Billy, it's not like that at all. You sound like you've got some crazy idea or other. I don't know what it is.
No, and that's all right, but I want an answer. If I don't get it from you, I'll get it some other way.
Hang on one second. If we're going to talk about this, I want to go into the study. It's a little more private there.
Fine. There was a click as Houston put Billy on hold. He sat in the phone booth, sweating, wondering if this was Houston's way of ditching him. Then there was another click.
You still there, Billy?
Yes.
Okay, Houston said, the note of disappointment in his voice both unmistakable and somehow comic. Houston sighed.
Duncan Hopley has got a case of runaway acne. Billy got to his feet and opened the door of the phone booth. Suddenly it was too hot in here.
Acne?
Pimples, blackheads, whiteheads, that's all. You happy?
Anyone else?
No. And, Billy, I don't exactly consider pimples off the wall.
You were starting to sound a little like a Stephen King novel for a while there, but it's not like that. Dunk Hopley's got a temporary glandular imbalance, that's all, and it's not exactly a new thing with him either. He has a history of skin problems going back to the 7th grade.
Very rational. But if you add Carrie Rossington with his alligator skin and William J. Halleck with his case of involuntary anorexia nervosa into the equation, it starts to sound a little like Stephen King again, wouldn't you say?
Patiently, Houston said.
You've got a metabolic problem, Bill. Carrie, I don't know, I've seen some
strange things, yes, I know, Billy said. Had this cocaine-sniffing gas bag really been his family doctor for 10 years? Dear God, was that the truth?
Have you seen Lars Arncaster lately?
No, Houston said impatiently. He's not my patient. I thought you said you only had one question.
Of course he's not your patient, Billy thought giddily. He doesn't pay his bills on time, does he? And a fellow like you, a fellow with expensive tastes, really can't afford to wait, can he?
This really is the last one, Billy said. When did you last see Duncan Hopley?
2 weeks ago.
Thank you.
Make an appointment next time, Billy,
Houston said in an unfriendly voice, and hung up. Hopley did not, of course, live on Lantern Drive, but the police chief's job paid well, and he had a trim New England salt box on Ribbon Maker Lane. Billy parked in the driveway at dusk, went to the door, and rang the bell.
There was no answer. He rang again. No answer. He leaned on the bell. Still no answer. He went to the garage, cupped his hands around his face, and peered in. Hopley's car, a conservative cordovan-colored Volvo, was parked in there. FVW1, the license plate read. There was no second car. Hopley was a bachelor. Billy went back to the door and began hammering on it. He hammered for nearly 3 minutes, and his arm was getting tired when a hoarse voice yelled, "Go away, fuck off!" "Let me in," Billy shouted back. "I have to talk to you." There was no answer. After a minute, Billy began to hammer again. There was no response at all this time. But when he stopped suddenly, he heard a whisper of movement on the other side of the door. He could suddenly picture Hopley standing there, crouching there, waiting for the unwelcome, insistent visitor to go away and leave him in peace. Peace, or whatever passed for it in Duncan Hopley's world these days. Billy uncurled his throbbing fist. "Hopley, I think you're there," he said quietly. "You don't have to say anything, just listen to me. It's Billy Halleck. 2 months ago I was involved in an accident. There was an old gypsy woman who was jaywalking." Movement behind the door, definite now, a shuffle, rustle. "I hit her and killed her. Now I'm losing weight. I'm not on a diet or anything like that, I'm just losing weight. About 75 pounds so far. If it doesn't stop soon, I'm going to look like the human skeleton in a carny sideshow." Carrie Rossington, Judge Rossington, presided at the preliminary hearing and declared there was no case. "He's developed some weird skin disease." Billy thought he heard a low gasp of surprise. "And he's gone out to the Mayo Clinic. The doctors have told him it isn't cancer, but they don't know what it is. Rossington would rather believe it is cancer than what he knows it really is." Billy swallowed. There was a painful click in his throat. "It's a gypsy curse, Hopley. I know how crazy that sounds, but it's the truth. There was an old man. He touched me when I came out of the hearing. He touched Rossington when he and his wife were at a flea market in Raintree." "Did he touch you, Hopley?" There was a long, long silence. And then one word drifted to Billy's ears through the mail slot, like a letter full of bad news from home. "Yes." "When? Where?"